We continue our studies in 1 Peter chapter 1, and we come this morning to verses 6 and 7. In this you rejoice, though now for a little while you may have to suffer various trials, so that the genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold, which though perishable is tested by fire, may redound to praise and glory and honour at the revelation of Jesus Christ. The title we've got down on the card for these two verses is Tested but Triumphant. Tested but Triumphant. Now, I'm not sure that I'm really entirely happy about that title. The word triumphant doesn't seem to be quite the right one. It suggests the idea that everything is just a little bit effortless, and that we just sail through trials and are scarcely aware of them. Now, it's quite clear that these Christians to whom Peter was writing, in one sense, could describe some of their trials as almost being like going through hell. Later in this epistle, their trials are described as a fiery ordeal. And no doubt for many of them, it was indeed literally a fiery ordeal in which they were put to the fire. And let's be in no doubt at all as we start off, the sort of trials and testings that you and I are going to face will often make us feel almost as if we were in a badder situation as theirs. We shall find ourselves saying, why does this happen to me? What's God doing? Has he forgotten me? How can I be expected to cope with this terrible sort of situation? We may feel sometimes that we're going through hell. Nevertheless, there is still a victory, a triumph, that Christians can lay hold of. As I've thought about New Testament teaching on this, I've sometimes summed it up in three little words, which may help as a sort of lead-in for our study this morning. The Christian victory is, first of all, eventual. In this life, we suffer, but we look forward to the life of the world to come when the sufferings of this world will be over. So in that sense, our Christian victory is eventual. Eventually, it's going to come. In the end, it will be ours. A second word that you can use with another strand of New Testament teaching about trials and victory is conditional. Conditional. In other words, our entering into the final victory is conditional on the way we face and come through our trials now. If we come through them in the right way, then that will win for us the victory. Our facing them rightly now is the condition of entering into the victory then. So, eventual, conditional, and thirdly, simultaneous. Simultaneous. And what I mean by that is that the Christian victory isn't just something far off in the future that we've got to wait for and hang on until it arrives. But there is a sense in which the future is always bursting in upon the present. Now, if you look at our two verses, you'll find that all three of those notes are present with us. For instance, the Christian victory is eventual. Look at the end of verse 7, where he speaks about the day coming when our faith will redound to praise and glory and honour at the revelation of Jesus Christ. There's the eventual victory. Then there's the note of victory being conditional. Verse 7, the beginning of the verse. The genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold, will be tested by fire, so that our faith is put to the test and the victory is conditional on how we face that test. And then also we've got the note of simultaneous, that victory is bursting in from the future into the present. Because in verse 6 he says this, in this you rejoice. He says you're rejoicing here and now in the midst of your trials. So all three of those words have got a basis in these two verses, that the Christian victory is eventual, it'll come in the end, it's conditional. Our winning it depends on the condition of facing the trials rightly. And it's simultaneous, bursting in even now. Nevertheless, Peter seems to look at these things from a slightly different perspective. Indeed, his order of expressing them is the reverse of the way I've put it. And so I've come to look at these verses in a slightly fresh light, and I want to enlarge the ideas I've already tried to express to you. And perhaps I can express it like this, by starting off by saying that as Christians, we live in two worlds at once, where here and now in this world, in this life, but already we're citizens of heaven. We're in two worlds at once. Now, let's take that thought and get three heads from it and see it in these verses. First of all, let's look at the two worlds separate. The two worlds separate. Verse 6. In this you rejoice, though now for a little while you may have to suffer various trials. I'd like to bring out the sense of the original a little bit more clearly by putting in an extra word or two. In this you rejoice, though now for a little while you may have to suffer sadness because of various trials. Now, do you see what he's saying about Christians? He says about Christians that at one and the same time, they can be rejoicing and they can be sad. They can be happy and be miserable. At one and the same time, but at different levels. Because at the start of the verse, he says, you rejoice. At the end of the verse, he says, you're going to have to suffer sadness through various trials. And if you know anything of yourself as a Christian, I'm sure you will find this to have been the case. That in our Christian experience, we can find that in a strange way, we are both sad and happy at the same time, but on different levels. What are those different levels? Well, our sadness. That springs from our earthly, material, temporal level. Here we are in this world, suffering trials, and it's not fun. And often we're very unhappy. But at the same time, on a heavenly, spiritual level, we have a grounds for rejoicing that nothing in this world can effect. Peter has spoken about the inheritance that lies up before us. Imperishable, undefiled, unfading, kept in heaven for us. Now there is our inheritance absolutely certain. And in that inheritance, because of it, we have a grounds of rejoicing that no one can take from us. I wonder if you picked up that little phrase as it was read in the Gospel. Jesus spoke about the fact that he would give to the disciples his joy. And he went on and said, no one will take your joy from you. Whatever men in this world may do to us, we have in Christ a grounds of rejoicing that no one can take from us. Now, as we face these two worlds, these two levels of feeling, which of them is more real? We begin by thinking that this world is the real one. We're conscious of its sufferings and its pains. But part of the experience of the Christian is that you begin to discover that the world to come, in fact, is a more real one, and it's not simply a world to come, but it's a world which, in one sense, has already come. The future is not just future, but it bursts in upon the present. See this note in these verses that we're studying this term. For instance, verse 5 spoke about a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. That speaks of it way on in the future. But then verse 9, as the outcome of your faith, you obtain the salvation of your souls. The future is so vivid, so real, that the future becomes, in a sense, present. It bursts in upon the now. It casts its shadow backward. So that we're already, in a sense, more aware of the future than we are of the present. This is part of what was meant by that vivid little expression that we looked at a couple of weeks ago in verse 3. The expression, the living hope. Which means a hope that isn't just something sort of vague and far away, but a hope that is absolutely certain. And so you see, the unseen world, the future world, becomes for us more real. It's the world that is imperishable, undefiled, unfading. This present world is the insubstantial, the unreal one, the one that's going to disappear, that's going to be snuffed out by, like the morning mist when it's snuffed out by the rising sun. It'll be dispersed. But the future world, the unseen world, will remain. That's the real one. Our living hope brings it present to us, and already we have manifestations of it coming into the now. So there's two worlds separate. Second heading, two worlds in conflict. Two worlds in conflict. Now you see, if these two worlds are there, in a sense there's a battle between them always going on. Which is the real world? Which is going to be for you the real world? Which is the one that you're going to count on? Which is the one whose rewards you're going to feel are worth living for and dying for? Which is the one whose rewards are going to be the ones that determine how you act and how you think? That's a question that we can't ask, we can't answer, until we're put to the test. Until a practical situation arises before us in which we have to choose. And so Peter says in verse 7, the genuineness of your faith has got to be like gold which is tested in the fire. Now, what's the point of the illustration? Gold, as it is dug out from the earth, may be mixed with much dross, much impure material that isn't the real thing. It's put into the fire so that all that is false and counterfeit may be burnt up and removed, and the genuine part may be left and may be shown to be visible and may be left there in all its purity. Now this is the picture Peter has in mind. You make great professions about believing in God, about counting Him more real, His rewards, the ones worth living for and dying for. But when it comes to the point, will you live for His rewards? Will you die for them? Or will you renounce them and turn to the world's rewards and live and die for them? Well, only in the test can you answer that question. You must pass through the fire so that all that is counterfeit and superficial in your faith may be burnt up and taken away, and a genuine part left behind. And you may know what your faith does mean to you and what you are going to do on account of it. How does this work out? Well, it often works out like this, that you find yourself in this life wanting to do two things at once. Wanting to do two contradictory things. There's a sense in which you can want to do what you don't want to do. Am I speaking double Dutch? I hope not. Take a simple illustration. You get somebody who says, well, he loves cross-country running. Well, from one point of view, it's absurd to say that he loves it. Why? It's pain, it's grief. He goes out, it's bitterly cold, it's muddy, it's slushy, it's miserable, he gets a stitch and all the rest of it. And yet on a different level, it's worthwhile. It gives a sense of achievement. He knows that he will get a satisfaction out of doing that far richer and more rewarding and more lasting than any sort of satisfaction he'll get from just frousting in front of the television all the afternoon or whatever it may be. Now, in the same way, we find ourselves confronted with powerful desires. On a lower level, on an evil level, there are desires like the desires for self-indulgence, the desires to enjoy the pleasures of sin, the desires not to worry about other people and obligations, the desires to be superior to them, and so on. Nevertheless, we find ourselves hating those desires and not wanting to follow them. And sometimes people in this situation in which they're torn apart get very distressed and upset. A Christian will come to you and say, oh, I must be such an awful Christian. My Christian life doesn't seem to be going well at all. I want to do all the wrong things. I have no desire to walk in God's way. Why is he so distressed? Because although there are these low desires which present themselves to his conscious level so strongly, nevertheless there is a deeper and a stronger desire that pulls him in an opposite direction, so that he doesn't want to obey those desires that he does have. He wants to do on one level what they tell him to do, and yet on a deeper level he doesn't want to. He knows that those low desires will bring no real or lasting reward. The pleasures of sin only last for a season. They're always followed by that miserable experience of saying, whatever did I go and do that for? What a fool I've been. He knows that those desires won't make him happy. He's begun to catch hold of those invisible rewards that God offers. And yet still, the things of this world seem so much more tangible. And though he has these new desires, such a Christian as this is often unaware that they are there. He doesn't see them, yet they are there. If they weren't there, there wouldn't be this tension within him. So don't be distressed if you find yourself torn apart like this. Try rather to identify these two pulls within you and to see which is the one worth following. And the real test is not how you feel, but what you do. We've often today in our Christian circles got it the other way round. We lay an awful lot of stress on having nice feelings, being happy within ourselves, having a sense of peace with God, and so on. There are some situations in which the only way in which you can have peace with God is by not having peace within yourself, by having this sense of conflict. It isn't feeling right. It isn't what you feel. It isn't a matter of there being these desires pulling in opposite ways. The real crunch issue is, which desire are you going to follow? Are you going to go and enjoy that sin? Or are you going to go and do that piece of Christian service? Or help that person who is in trouble and difficulty? Even while you're saying, oh, I don't want to do this. Why should I? Why can't he look after himself? And so on. And even while you're sort of kicking yourself and groaning and moaning, nevertheless you do it. Now there is the invisible beginning to win the victory. So there's two worlds in conflict. I hope these things are part of your experience. Finally, we see two worlds made one. Two worlds made one. There will in the end be only one world. In the end, this present world will be shown to be perishable, defiled, and fading. It will disappear. Not only will that be the case of this world, but that will be the case of all that is lower within us, all the old nature. That will be shown to be unreal. And in that day, only what is real will remain, and it will be revealed. We've got that word at the end of verse 7, haven't we? Praise and glory and honour at the revelation of Jesus Christ. He who is already king, but invisible, will then be revealed and will be shown to be king, and will not merely be king, but will be seen to be king. And in the same way, your faith, if it's had a genuine part in it, will not merely be a real faith, but will be seen to be a real faith. And it will be rewarded to praise and glory and honour at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And yet, that isn't really even there, the finishing point. Those three words, praise and glory and honour, may be seen as what Christ will bestow upon you if your faith has stood the test. And yet there's another and a deeper standpoint in which they will be seen to be the things that redound on Christ himself. Because if you stand the test, what in the end will it show? Something about you? Oh no, it won't show anything about you. It will show something about Christ. It will show about him something which is beyond the imaginings of this world. It will show that the Lord Jesus Christ has the power to maintain the loyalty of his followers even when they face the most acute and difficult trials. Now that's a remarkable thing. Anyone will follow a leader who gives them nice things and no difficulties. That sort of leader will have no difficulties at all in getting a host of followers. But if a leader can win followers, even when in following him they experience terrible trials, and if in those trials they maintain their loyalty unquenchable and still hold fast to him and count him more precious than anything else in the world, that is a demonstration of the worth, the praise, the glory and honour of that one in whom they have put their trust. It's something before which all created beings will bow in wonder. Peter himself has a hint of this later on in this chapter. I mustn't pick on it too much, but if you look at the end of verse 12, you'll see this remarkable little phrase. These are things into which angels long to look. Angels long to look. This battle between the two worlds, as it were, it's a cosmic one. There's a host of spectators. You and I live in this world where we're surrounded by human spectators. But in the unseen world, there are angelic spectators and devilish spectators. And they're wanting to know, is Christ going to win the final victory? Is he going to prove himself to be the one worth following through thick and thin? And we are the instruments who have the privilege of being able to demonstrate that he is thus worth following. And then at that day, there will be praise and honour and glory for him. So, two worlds separate. Separate out those two levels of feeling in yourself. Don't be miserable because you're depressed, as people sometimes are. You can be happy when you're depressed, because you live in two worlds at once. Two worlds in conflict. Which is going to win the victory? You're wanting to do what you don't want to do. Well, what are you going to do? Are you going to go Christ's way or the world's way? Two worlds in one. If you will be standing firm to Christ, then in the end, when there is only one world left, it will have been demonstrated that Christ is the one to whom belongs honor and glory and praise. Amen.